The Radio Today program with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
I'd like to ask you a direct question. Are you embarrassed to pick up your paycheck?
Do you know, I just feel very lucky every day, is the answer to that.
I do think you're overpaid.
I don't even really want to answer that because I feel like it's not the moment for me.
You spend your lifetime asking people questions.
Yeah.
Now I'm asking you a direct question.
I'm listed as having a salary of between £700,000 and £750,000. How do you justify that?
Same way, you know, you're a fantastic broadcaster, you know, you provide a huge public service.
Well, that was probably the interview question of the year so far. Radio 2's Jeremy Vine asking his big boss, James Purnell, Director of Radio and Education, about his own salary. And before that, Harry Jones from Neath, a caller challenging Jeremy on the same subject. Hello, I'm Trevor Down. This is the weekly podcast from radiotoday.co.uk. And in this episode, we're going to talk about the revelations about what the top BBC presenters take home. Later on, we'll hear from the agent, Nick Canham, who looks after some of UK radio's biggest names. But first, I've been to see Roger Mosey, former controller of Five Live, director of BBC Sport, mastermind of the 2012 Olympics. He negotiated a few BBC talent contracts in his time, and I wondered what he thought of the publication of this so-called BBC Rich List.
Well, I've always been against this kind of disclosure. I do think the BBC should be a transparent, accountable organisation. I think it should be accountable for the total amount of money it spends. But I think it always leads to huge problems if you start publishing individual salary and individual comparators.
Now, what would you do as a manager and somebody who's worked with talent like this, you know, when you're inevitably going to get one DJ or one presenter coming and knocking on the door and saying, wait a minute, why am I paid half as much as the guy who does the other show next to me?
Well, that's why Tony Hall is right, I think, to say that it's inflationary. It will lead to people saying, I want to match X as another individual. Of course, the reason why people earn different amounts of money was it depends where you come from, and it also sometimes depends on what offers you get from other people. And I certainly, as a BBC manager, sometimes increase somebody's pay specifically because they got a competitive offer from another broadcaster, and therefore you can see that there is a market rate issue there. Now, I think the question is, in a perfect world, if you adjust presenter A to a certain level, should presenter B go to a certain level too? But then that becomes incredibly inflationary. And it may be that presenter A has been offered a large amount of money by a commercial TV company, presenter B hasn't. And that's why the differentials sometimes come into existence.
What do you think about the accusation, and Tony Hall's used these words, that it's a poacher's charter, that it means that commercial broadcasters are going to be sitting around today saying, ha-ha, if that person's only paid that much, maybe I could put a bid in?
I think that's true to a significant extent. I do accept the argument that some of the BBC critics make, that in radio, the BBC is so dominant in the market, certainly in terms of its share of audience, that it may be not quite the same argument there as it is in commercial television. But I used to find that when I was director of sport, that there was pressure at one point for us to reveal what we paid for sports rights. And of course, the BBC is subject to freedom of information, as is Channel 4, in a way ITV and Sky aren't. And if in radio you'd said, you know, test match special costs us £20,000 a year, whatever it was, in that case, if you were Talk Sport, you'd bid £21,000 a year, and it would put the BBC at a massive commercial disadvantage. So I do think this is bad for the BBC in its commercial negotiations with talent and with potentially outside bodies.
Could I put it to you, though, that that same argument was used about management? It was said a few years ago that you shouldn't reveal what managers, controllers, senior people at the BBC got paid for the same reason, that they might easily get poached. Now, we can not only know their salaries, but we can see, you know, what they've had for lunch. We can see, you know, the minutiae of their expenses claims. It doesn't appear to have launched, you know, a massive transfer of senior BBC managers into the commercial sector.
I do think it's different, actually. I think it's right that managers' pay, including mine, was published. And I think the truth of it is that very few managers are actually in as acute a commercial competitive position as talent. So I think as a as a weapon of accountability to keep management costs down, publishing management pay was actually the right thing to do. I think, though, that when you're talking about talent and about sports rights and about contracts for formats, in that case, it is commercially damaging to the BBC to have to publish those. And I don't see that there's a particular public accountability issue as long as the BBC publishes a total talent pay bill and it manages that properly. What you have to rely on sometimes is the managers managing, and they will have to make judgments. They will have to fit within their budget, and that's usually the best discipline.
The other issue that's emerged is the gender pay gap, that there's far more men on this list than there are women. Tony Hall has said that he wants to put that right, and he's given himself a deadline of 2020 to achieve it, which seems overconfident to me. But you're one of the guilty men. You know, you presided over this system where women were paid less than men. Why did it happen, and can it be put right?
Well, I don't think I would categorise myself as guilty in this case, in that I did promote a lot of talent, a lot of diversity of talent. I think, again, it comes back to the issue that sometimes you may have presenter A who's been offered a large amount of money elsewhere and presenter B who hasn't. And there are certainly a number of female presenters, including, I see today, Fiona Bruce and others, who do get very significant pay levels, and in some cases a lot more than the men. So I think this probably reflects a gender bias within the industry over the years, which is now being put right, and it should be put right. But if you are going to put it right, my guess is you're going to inflate salaries upwards to the top levels rather than take them down, which might be the preferred answer.
I think this is the point that Michel Hussain was making with Tony Hall on the Today programme this morning, that when he was saying we're going to equalise the pay levels, she said, are you going to make men earn less then? And that's probably not going to happen.
It's completely the right question. I know the BBC has taken some talent pay levels down, but it's a very difficult process, and also it doesn't really stand up to logic sometimes. So if somebody is worth £600,000 one year, why are they then only worth £500,000 the next year? And the BBC would have to face the fact it might in that case lose some of the talent. But so I think you're right that if you do bring the gender pay levels together, it's going to be an upward process, and the BBC might end up spending more on talent because of this freedom to know what people are earning.
No names here, but a well-known Radio 4 female broadcaster said to me, the reason we get paid less than the blokes is because we're too nice, that we don't go in and argue hard enough. Do you think there's any truth in that?
I don't think it is. I mean, I've dealt with some presenter talent over the years, male and female, who are both, you know, voracious in their demands. And you have to recognise here that the BBC is not the only guilty party here, because I saw that Gary Lineker blamed his agent, who is a very nice man who I know very well, called John Holmes. And it's certainly true that agents try to get the best deals for their talent. And it's often agents that you're dealing with. And if you're someone like Gary, you have a wide range of people you could go and work for, from ITV to Sky Sports or whatever. And agents get the best deal. And what you are reflecting in talent pay usually is a market. And as I say, I think honestly much more of a market than with management pay, where I think sometimes, you know, the idea that the great fleet of BBC managers, in which I include myself, are all going to go and decamp to ITV, Sky or the Bauer Group, I think is just not very likely. Whereas in talent, it's a real threat that someone is going to go to another broadcaster, and the investment the BBC has made in bringing that talent along will be lost and the benefit goes elsewhere.
Well, on that note, Roger, thank you. Let's go and talk to an agent now.
Broadcast Bionics, innovative solutions for creative radio people.
Joining me on the line now is Nick Canham from Vivian Clore Artist Management, who looks after a number of radio's household names. Nick, what's your first reaction to this list?
Firstly, I think it's a ridiculous position the BBC have been put in. I don't think there was anything wrong with the previous system of a benchmark of 450,000 and saying how many people were above that. I think it's bad news for the presenters having their annual salaries put about. I don't think it does anybody any good. It does Daily Mail headlines good. It does a commercial sector good. I tweeted earlier on saying that I think it creates a great poaching list for commercial stations and television and radio.
Have you had any of your clients come banging on your door saying, Nick, you've got to go back in and get me more money because these other guys on my station have paid more than I am?
No, and funny enough, no. I've had one phoning me up on a jokey basis to say why they're not on the list, and that's it. Because I think people who work in the industry and work side by side with a number of these people realise that what's missing from this whole list, which is, you know, being gratuitously displayed all over the place, is any context. There's nothing to say, right, okay, if you're Nicky Campbell and you're getting this much money, what are you doing for that much money? From a radio perspective, Trevor, you and I have both worked in the game a long time. You know, some considerable decades more than me. A radio show isn't just from 6 o'clock till 9 o'clock in the morning or, you know, 10 to one. It's hours and hours of prep in each show, and there's years and years of experience that go into that. So to be in that bracket of 4 to 450 or, you know, 2 to 250 or wherever people are, it's not just on a 3 hours a day basis. And that's what's missing.
And these figures, of course, do include their television work, don't they? So some people just do 5 days a week on the radio, but others also have, you know, substantial TV commitments.
Well, Trevor, I mean, I was listening to James Pennell on being interviewed by Jeremy Vine earlier, you know, and Jeremy Vine made the point to him that John Humphreys is on 600 to 650, and Sarah Montague, who's another presenter on the Today programme, doesn't appear on the list. But that doesn't mean that for the same work, they're paid huge sums of difference. You know, John Humphrey's figure includes Mastermind. It includes anything else he does extra for the BBC. What we should have had, if they wanted to do it this way or if they had to do it this way, is that you've got to provide the context and say, right, for John Humphrey's, for the Today programme, his fee was this. Sarah Montague was this. And then you can make a direct comparison. At the moment, what we've got is we've got people looking at a list and going, oh, they're vastly overpaid, but we don't know what they're paid for.
The coverage of this, Nick, particularly in, you know, the Daily Mail and other places who are always banging the drum against the BBC, the implication is that the BBC management who do these kind of deals are a bit of a pushover. In your experience, and you've done lots of deals to get your people on the BBC, is it easy to get a lot of extra money out of the BBC, or do they drive a hard bargain?
Getting money out of the BBC is like getting blood out of a stone. It's a torturous process, and any other agent listening to this and any presenter who negotiates their own money will say exactly the same thing. The problem the BBC has, amongst other things, is that if you try to negotiate with the person who's employing you, by and large, you can't. You then have to go and talk to somebody else, or they have to go and talk to somebody else. You can't just have a one-on-one negotiation. If I'm doing a negotiation with somebody at ITV, it's invariably you're negotiating with the person who they're going to be working for. With the BBC, it goes to talent rights, and you've got to have a conversation with somebody there who's totally disconnected to the process. And if you're not happy there, you've got to go back to your controller of a radio station or producer on a TV show and say, look, I can't get through to them why there should be more money. Then they go and speak to the talent rights department. And, it's a convoluted process. So, no, it's never easy to get money out of the BBC, and it's getting harder.
And from your experience, do these sums roughly equate with what people are paid in commercial radio? You know, one thinks about people like Nick Ferrari, James O'Brien, you know, there are people on Capital, I'm sure, and Heart who are paid big money. Would they be roughly the same as the people that we're reading about in this BBC list?
I think you've got people at LBC, you've got people on Heart, you've got people on Absolute, you've got people on Capital who are probably paid either the same or more. I'm sure, you know, Chris Moyles is probably on more than Nick Grimshaw, you know, doing Radio X to a smaller audience. Last year there was bandying around figures of what Nick Ferrari earned, and I think that would put him on a par with what the key figures on the Today programme are earning. But then somebody doing, you know, a mid-afternoon show somewhere on a regional commercial station is not earning the same money as Scott Mills. So I think for the big hitters in commercial radio, they are probably earning the same, if not more, than the big hitters on BBC radio. That doesn't include, obviously, somebody like Chris Evans, but we've all in the industry heard the rumours, and, you know, I'm sure if Michael Foster wants to pick up the phone, he might dispute or confirm them, that Evans ended up on Radio 2 because Capital offered him the breakfast show gig, and a call was put in and said, look, he's about to sign with Capital, do the BBC want him? And they said, yes, we do, and created Drive Time at Radio 2 for him. Now, he would have been earning more money doing breakfast at Capital than he would have been doing Radio 2. Tarrant was earning, by all accounts, about 1.3 million for breakfast at Capital. So you know, that commercial market will still pay more than the BBC.
The other issue that's been raised is the question of gender balance and the fact that women seem to be being paid less by the BBC than men are. In your experience, and you've negotiated contracts with the BBC for men and women, are the BBC sort of tempted usually to offer less money for a woman broadcaster than for a man?
I think a few years ago, it was far more evident that a female and a male presenting the same show for the same length of time were paid different rates. That wasn't based on experience, that wasn't based on anything, it just was. Now, I think you'll find if there is a male and a female hosting together, similar skills, similar experience, you know, there's caveats in all of this, they are paid the same amount of money. I the last contract I did where I represented the female but didn't represent the male, but I knew the relationship and I knew the money, they're paid exactly the same amount of money. And I think certainly over the past 3 years, there's been huge strides made to make that happen.
Well, these and other issues will be debated over the coming weeks and months, won't they? People's salaries,
once
they're in the public domain.
I'm sure Mr. Dacre on $1.5 million a year will have great fun complaining about people earning $500,000.
I bet you wish you had 10% of his money, Nick.
Far more than that. 10% is too cheap.
Thank you for giving us the talent agent's perspective. Nick Canham, thank you for talking to the Radio Today programme.
No problem at all, Trevor. A pleasure.
Well, you can read all the numbers at radiotoday.co.uk. David Lloyd in a minute, but first with the Radio Today news, Steve Clarkson.
Thanks, Trevor. As you've been hearing, the BBC's revealed what it pays its top talent earning more than £150,000 a year. Chris Evans is top of the list across the BBC with more than £2.2 million paid to him in 2016-17, though that figure is likely to include his work on Top Gear. Next on the list of people who do radio come Graham Norton, Jeremy Vine, John Humphreys and Steve Wright. They were all paid more than £500,000 last year. You can see the full list at radiotoday.co.uk. Also this week, tributes have been paid to Richard Findlay, who's died aged 73. He was the first voice on Radio 4 and went on to be the CEO of Scottish Radio Holdings until it sailed to EMAP in 2005. We've learned that Dave Berry's going to be doing drive time on Absolute Radio from October. He's currently on gardening leave after leaving Capital earlier this year. Radio Scotland boss Jeff Szczesinski's leaving the BBC after 25 years. He's announced he's departing in the new year. Janice Long is staying on at BBC Radio Wales after her stint on evenings through the summer. The station also introducing a new Sunday morning speech programme from September. The London AM station Spectrum Radio has applied to Ofcom for a major change to its format. It wants to go all speech with a focus on business and finance, sport, entertainment, current affairs and essential information. It's currently a music station aimed at various different ethnic minority communities across the capital. More community stations have found themselves in trouble with Ofcom this week. Ribble FM in Lancashire has been judged in breach on a standards case after playing a Dr. Dre track full of F-words. St. FM in Essex is in trouble over recordings provided to the regulator not matching the programme scheduled, and two stations have been put on notice that Ofcom could take further action after they failed to meet their key commitments. That's Beyond Radio in Lancaster and Morecambe and Tamworth station TCR FM. And meanwhile, Ofcom has opened up another round of applications for community radio services. You can see the full list of areas across England, Scotland and Northern Ireland where the regulator is considering issuing licences at radiotoday.co.uk.
Your best content, shareable and discoverable on any platform. Oasis from Broadcast Bionics helps you build a closer relationship with your listeners. Welcome to the social studio at bionics.co.uk.
Industrial action was pretty common in a 70s world, wasn't it? Not least in broadcasting. And at LBC, it's 40 years this week since the station was off air, owing to a dispute between journalists and management.
261.
This is LBC 261 medium wave and 97.3 VHF. Owing to an industrial dispute, normal services on both LBC and Independent Radio News have been suspended for the time being. We hope to resume our regular programming as soon as possible.
Hello, this is Dickie Arbiter bringing you the good news that the industrial dispute at LBC is now over and that there'll be an IRN news bulletin every hour on the hour from midnight tonight. Join us then.
Phew, thank goodness. LBC in strife this week in 77. BBC Local Radio celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, and part of the case for establishing those trial stations at a reluctant BBC was a series of programmes recorded in the early 60s, including in Hull this week in 1961.
Radio Hull, your local BBC station. The time, 6 o'clock. Well, good morning, it's Michael Barton here in the Guildhall on a rather uncertain morning, a few splashes of rain about.
I was asked to go to Hull, which is my old hometown, did an experiment there. Others were taking place in Durham and Poole, down on the south coast, in Norwich and other places in the country. What Frank was doing, very cleverly, was setting up these small experiments for a few days at a time, recording everything that was done, and he was building up his little archive, which was going to be used in the future, to great effect, to persuade the doubters, the politicians, those with influence, that this is the way forward.
Michael Barton, who was to launch Radio Sheffield and in due course was to be the head of the BBC local radio network. If you're of a certain age, you'll recall the moon landing in 1969 this week. DLT does.
And in fact, I must apologise if at the very beginning of today's show I sounded a bit drowsy, but as you can well imagine, I was very intrigued by what was going on upstairs, you know, on the moon. And of course, I stayed up till about 5 o'clock watching those fantastic men walking about on the moon surface, taking photographs and everything. I think it's a tremendous feat. And once again, I'd like to offer congratulations to the American nation. That was really fantastic.
One small step for DLT this week in 1969. This week, 29 years ago, a nighttime sustaining service was launched for commercial radio under the generic on-air name of The Superstation. The operation was called Radio Radio. It broadcast evening programmes across the network, created originally by David Campbell and Rob Jones and backed by Richard Branson. Early programmes featured some mighty names.
Superstation, Johnny Walker.
It's the Johnny Walker Show on a Wednesday night from the Superstation. Have we got some good music to you?
For you? Have we got some good music to you?
Are you kidding? Leave it out now. Also, we have Rockfile News and Compact Connection, the clue for Compact Connection.
Well, listen, that's the end of the show, I'm afraid. Yet another show bites the dust. Thanks very much for listening to us. Thanks to Carrie and, of course, young Andy for sitting so ably and trying not to yawn all the way through. Thanks to all my guests.
Up next, though, on the Superstation, a classic from Foreigner. It's now 3:28. Good morning.
Cole Kingston.
The biggest, the brightest, and the best. This is the Superstation.
The Superstation, on which you'd also have heard people like Janice Long, Steve Davis, Nicky Horn, Bob Harris, Diana Luke, Ruby Wax, and Jonathan Ross as well, produced by Chris Evans. Linking up at all would have been a long way from the thoughts of those launching stations, originally stations like Metro, this week in 74.
It is 6 a.m. on Monday, the 15th of July, 1974. This is Bruce Lewis saying welcome to Metropolitan Broadcasting. We are now going on the air for the very first time, bringing independent radio to you who live in the Tyne and Wear areas. This, above all, will be your radio station, and our aim will always be to please you, our listener.
Yes, Metro would aim to please you, even if your call to its phone-in didn't make much sense.
Good afternoon, nice to be back again, and let's take our first phone call. Waiting on the line, we've got Bob Armstrong. Hello, Bob. Hello, Bob.
Hello, can I help you?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Armstrong here.
Okay.
Yes, what can I do for you?
Aren't you ringing us?
No, you rang me.
The Metro phone-in is now open on Newcastle 883188. Waiting for your call is Kevin Rowntree.
Well, I think if you've got a solicitor on the job, you should ask him to take it a stage further. That's the best thing.
So where do I go from now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you should put that question to your solicitor, quite honestly.
I mean, he just agreed to have it restrained, but the coat's unwearable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you should keep the pressure up on the solicitor to get some satisfaction for you. Keep on to the solicitor about it.
Well, what can I do?
Oh, keep on to your solicitor about it. Let's talk to Mrs. Noon, the next caller. Good afternoon, Mrs.
Good afternoon,
Noon.
Kevin.
Hello.
Hello. One other person whose patience has likely been stretched at times, not least by its discerning vocal audience, is Gwyneth Williams. It's 7 years since she was appointed controller of Radio 4.
Yes, we've got 5 years of cuts, and we have been cut proportionately more than we've ever been cut before. And that's fair enough, really, because we've had to take our share of much wider BBC cuts. You know how deep those have been since the flat licence fee settlement. The approach I've taken is to cut back Radio 4 Extra quite strongly in order to protect originations on Radio 4.
Gwyneth Williams speaking earlier in her tenure. If you were making a list of the best radio features of all time, and let's not do that, I suspect the Guess the Year programme would be on the list, as would this.
And the story came out. He said he couldn't hurt her anymore, and she ought to know something that he'd never told her, which was that he was bisexual. In fact, he'd been sleeping with a man the night she'd given birth to a second daughter.
Our tune, which began with Simon Bates this week in 1980. So, with the launch of Magic 8-8 in Leeds this week, 27 years ago...
That brand new radio station that you're going to love over the months and weeks ahead.
Everett fired from Radio 1 47 years ago.
She only passed because she crammed a fiver in his hand.
And Grampian TV selling loss-making Scott FM for £5.25 million 21 years ago. Those are this week's Radio Moments. Radio
Moments! Thank you, David Lloyd, Stu Clarkson, Nick Canham and Roger Mosey. This has been a TDC production for Radio Today. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week. Cheers.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.